Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm glad to be with you today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn. It's Monday morning, and that means it's time for all things political. And today we'll be talking about the latest in Campaign 2012. There's a new poll out from the Des Moines Register, and we'll be talking about the results of that, and also Herman Cain's new problem. And, of course, going beyond that, we'll find out what's up with Occupy Wall Street. Our guest this hour is Carl P. Lubsdorf. He's the former Washington bureau chief of the Dallas Morning News. He currently writes a weekly column for the paper and its website at dallasnews.com. And we welcome your phone calls today and your emails, your questions and comments on all things political of the week that was at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And our email is talk@wpr.org. And Carl Lubsdorf, thank you so much for joining us today.
Veronica, I'm happy to be with you.
Well, let's talk about that new poll from the Des Moines Register. Now, this is a pretty well-established poll, as I understand it. You want to tell us what it said?
Sure. And it's sort of regarded as the, you know, with all the polling being done, as the one that the politicians and the press look at. I think there were really two main interesting things about it. The numbers in the poll showed Herman Cain and Mitt Romney virtually tied at the top. Cain had 23, Romney had 22. But the really interesting part of it is the fact that fully 75% of the people who were polled in the poll said that whatever their current choice, they might change it. So that, you know, I have to take it all with a grain of salt. It sort of indicates that after months and months of campaigning in Iowa, and they've come various amounts of times, Cain and Romney actually less than some of the others. The race in Iowa, which holds the first caucuses, is very much up in the air, and it has not yet formed, you know, the shape it will take on January 3rd. The second thing that was interesting about the poll was that, and it really sort of matched up with what we've seen nationally, Mitt Romney always gets between a quarter and a third of the vote. In any poll that's taken, except in New Hampshire, where he runs a little higher. He, of course, was governor of Massachusetts and has a summer home in New Hampshire and has spent a lot of time there. About 50% of the vote is divided among a group of conservative candidates, Herman Cain, Rick Perry, Michelle Bachmann, Newt Gingrich, Rick Santorum, and it's sort of floating out there. I mean, I didn't include Ron Paul in that. He gets his 10 to 12%, and that's pretty stable. But the other vote, this big conservative block of 50% perhaps of Republican voters, is very fluid. At one point, a lot of them were for Donald Trump. Then Michelle Bachmann had a run there. Then when Rick Perry came into the race, they were for Rick Perry, and now they're for Herman Cain. And I would suggest that although Herman Cain has had a lot of enthusiasm among conservative activists in the Republican Party, he's a very compelling speaker, that his vote, his strong vote, is really sort of a none-of-the-above vote. It's a parking place for many Republicans who haven't quite figured where they're going to go.
Well, that's interesting, because I guess he's seen as the guy who's not really a politician.
Right, and that's, of course, an attractive thing this year. It's sort of ironic because one of the Republican complaints against President Obama is that he was too inexperienced and, you know, didn't understand the job. And here we have Herman Cain, who's never held an elective office, leading the Republican polls. But as much as there's enthusiasm, I mean, the conservative activists, these are the Tea Party people. These are the people who nominated and elected a number of members of the House of Representatives without prior political experience, who came to Washington determined to stop things as they were, and who were very involved in the fight last summer over the debt ceiling. These are the kinds of voters who are, you know, voting, who say now their preference is Herman Cain or Michelle Bachmann, and they're going to have a big voice in Republican politics, especially in Iowa. You know, Iowa is sort of unique in the way its electorate is formed. It's caucuses and not primaries, and the turnout in caucuses, last time it was 110,000, 118,000 people in the Republican caucuses. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, barely over 20% of the registered Republican electorate in the state. And it's a turnout that is heavily skewed to the more conservative Republicans. In the last 20 years, they have been a big voice in the Republican caucuses in Iowa. The party used to be seen as a much more moderate, centrist Republican party. That part of the party has diminished. Many of those people have become independents or even Democrats. What's left of that group is, for the most part, going to support Mitt Romney. And he's going to get, you know, a quarter, perhaps 30% of the vote, just because he is the only candidate who represents that group. It's even conceivable he could come in first if all the conservatives divide up enough.
Interesting. Well, what do you make, or how much do you make, of the fact that Rick Perry seems to be slipping quite a bit?
Well, I think, you know, Rick Perry came into the race late, and in fact, he decided to run late. And it looks like his people spent a lot of time figuring out, you know, the shape of the Republican Party, how they could raise money, who might be some of the, you know, main people who would support them. But candidates who run for president almost always have to, if they're not familiar with national issues because they've been a state office holder, have to sort of bone up on that because the debates take place and they have play a big part in the, you know, the pre-primary, pre-caucus part of the race. And by all signs, Governor Perry, quite familiar with Texas issues and what he's done as governor, was not as familiar with the national issues, and he had a very tough time. And part of the problem was, you know, he came into the race as sort of, as soon as he came in, given the fact that there wasn't a very strong candidate among these conservatives, he suddenly jumped to the top of the pile. I mean, he's been governor for 10 years. He has a very good record on job creation. It's the second biggest state in the country. And he's a very, he's a good campaigner. He's an attractive person. So all that, mm-hmm. you know, and he sort of jumped to the top of the race before he was really ready to engage with the issues. And, you know, you've got Mitt Romney, who ran before, is very knowledgeable on these issues, and a number of people like Newt Gingrich and Michelle Bachmann, who have, you know, had to deal with them in Congress, and so know a lot of this stuff. So it's, he had a lot of trouble with that, and he didn't do well in these debates, and so much to the point where his people were talking about perhaps he would skip some of the upcoming debates. There aren't quite a large number of debates, I think 18 scheduled. It's gotten a little bit out of control, and I suspect not all of them will take place as planned.
Mm-hmm.
But I think his people came to the realization, perhaps guided by the press coverage of his decision to perhaps opt out, that that would not be a good idea, that if he is to make a comeback, he has to participate and engage with his rivals and show that he is capable of being president. And regain some of the support, and I think that is not impossible for him to do, especially given the tenuous nature of the Kane candidacy. And we're seeing this week, you know, let me segue into that,
right.
You know, the potential problems for Herman Kane. You know, what happens when people run for president is, and when they, especially when they get taken seriously, the press starts delving into their background and looking to see if there's some things that perhaps they didn't put on their resume and on their website.
All right. There's a new level of scrutiny that gets really ramped up.
There's an enormous amount of scrutiny. And, you know, candidates who've run for state office and run in states are always astounded. I remember when Bill Clinton was running for president, and he'd had a lot of scrutiny in Arkansas. He was a controversial figure there. But it started all started again when he ran for president, and his attitude was, you know, well, I've been vetted, and well, welcome to presidential politics. And for someone like Herman Kane, who's never been, you know, in a race for office, it was inevitable that this would start. And It's not inevitable that any candidate would have problems in his or her background, although most of them have at least something that is interesting and potentially controversial, unless they've led such a boring life that they didn't have. I guess Tim Pawlenty, the former governor of Minnesota, there wasn't much, you know, that people found out about him that they didn't know. And he's, of course, no longer in the race. But anyway, this charge emerged. Politico came up with this story, by all signs well-researched and carefully reported, that when Mr. Cain was head of the Restaurant Association during a period after he left Godfather's Pizza and had this sort of lobbying job in Washington with the organization that represents restaurants around the country, that there were two instances of sexual harassment charges against him, which were settled by large payouts to the people involved. We don't know much more than that. Mr. Cain has denied it.
Well, he's denied it today. Apparently, yesterday when Politico confronted him,
he
answered
it
by saying, "Have you ever been accused of sexual harassment?"
Well, again, this shows his inexperience as a candidate, because when this kind of thing comes up, a candidate basically has to deal with it. And the longer they sort of waffle or try to avoid it, the more the controversy continues. The problem a candidate always faces is, if the charge is true, is it more damaging to admit the charge or to try to avoid doing it? And if it's not true, obviously they have an interest in getting that information out as fast as possible. My own personal view is that even if something is true, a candidate is better than getting it out and getting it settled and explaining, you know, this happened, this payoff, you know, I really was innocent, but I didn't really want the charge, this to keep continuing, so they settled. You know, there's always some kind of an explanation for the settlement that falls short of totally admitting a charge. And the important thing is to get this off the radar screen. It's ironic because this was the week of Mr. Cain is hoping to make a big splash in Washington. And, you know, he's really been a non-Washington, anti-Washington candidate. He's speaking today before the National Press Club. He's doing an interview today with Judy Woodruff for the Lara NewsHour. And he was speaking this morning, and speaking, I think, currently at the American Enterprise Institute.
So these that's going to be the main topic on the table, at least in the beginning of those.
Well, and at the press club, he has two options. One is to say it in his prepared remarks. You know, he's going to get a question about it during the question period. So, as I say, I'm not advising this or other candidates, but it is generally better to confront these matters up front to the extent you can and give the best explanation that you can give that both meets a certain level of, openness. On the other hand, you know, if there's something there, is somewhat protective. I mean, this can be done, but avoiding the question, as Mr. Cain sought to do yesterday, is not a good option. And so this, you know, this I say, he's up there in the 25%, and not only in Iowa, but in nationally. He's leading the national polls. He and Romney are up there. And if this controversy or other things damage Mr. Cain, and like the others, he begins to come down to earth, I think Governor Perry is still in a position to benefit from this. I mean, I think the two who are in position to benefit are Newt Gingrich, because he is a well-known figure, and Governor Perry, because he's not as well known, but he has more money than any of the candidates, except possibly Mitt Romney, and he's got the resources to continue to keep the race going beyond Iowa and New Hampshire. I mean, some of these candidates, you know, Rick Santorum, who has campaigned heavily in Iowa, has been in every one of its 99 counties. Michelle Bachmann, who is heavily counted on Iowa, if they don't do well in the caucuses, they'll find it very difficult to continue. Perry can do, you know, moderately well, and he will continue because he has to bank on the fact that the 25% for Romney isn't going to grow much, that the people who are against Romney While they're not sure who they're for, they know who they're against. One interesting thing in the Iowa poll, and of course, again, it's one state and one situation, there was a question there, you know, there were some likability questions, and the one who was the least liked was Michelle Bachmann with 16%, and second was Romney with 14%. And the one who was best liked with only 3% disliking him was Herman Cain, which is part of his appeal. He is very likable and a very good speaker.
Well, we're talking this hour with Carl Lubsdorf. He's former Washington Bureau Chief of the Dallas Morning News, and he currently writes a weekly column for the paper and its website at dallasnews.com. And we want to open the phone lines for you this morning if you want to weigh in on campaign 2012 as it's shaping up thus far, or we'll also be opening up the conversation on Occupy Wall Street as well and get our guest take on that and your take. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And you can send your email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert. I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert with you today. I'm in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And coming up at 10 o'clock, hope you'll stay tuned. We're going to get our Halloween spirit on as we talk about spooky reads, past and present, to help us enjoy this spooky holiday. This hour, it's All Things Political, and we're talking with Carl Lubsdorf, former Washington Bureau Chief of the Dallas Morning News, and he currently writes a weekly column for the paper and its website. And we'll take our first...
Wisconsin Tribune News Service, which carries it nationally, so it appears in a lot of papers around the country.
Okay, fantastic. Thanks. And let's go to our first caller right now. We've got Willem on the line from Colfax. Hello, Willem.
Hi. Excuse me. I would just think that, you know, the founders of this country were men of reason and logic and intellect, and I think what we have in this campaign seems to be all emotion, like this 999 thing, which is actually would shift even more of the burden away from, you know, corporations and the wealthy to middle-class people, and people are excited about that. I just don't understand the, you know, the logic in that, and as far as the people that are protesting, the young people and the other people, there's just some sort of injustice going on that I think people are sensing, and they have every right to do this. It's guaranteed by the First Amendment for the people to peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances. And also the Fourth Amendment has been eliminated, and people don't even talk about that, or this Citizens United case, which basically says money is speech, and which, you know, in practice means the people with the most money have the most speech, and they already control the media, and you know, so I don't think that our country is heading in a very good direction. And the Tea Party, it seems like whatever kind of tea they're drinking must cause amnesia, because the solutions that they want to the problem are the very causes of the problem: deregulation of the financial system, and, you know, decreased taxes to corporations and all that. Those are the things that they want. And these social issues, which really are personal and private issues in people's lives, whether they want to be Christians or not, or all these other, people want to marry, gay people want to marry, all those are not decisions that the government should be making. I mean, those are issues of liberty, personal liberty and freedom.
Well, let's get our guest in on that. There's a lot there to chew on. What do you think, Carl?
Well, there are quite a few questions there. First of all, it is ironic. I agree with the caller that, you know, that the most of the Republican candidates are basically advocating a return to the Bush economic policy, which didn't exactly help serve the country well. And as far as 999 is concerned, I think, you know, that's a gimmick. He may take it seriously, Mr. Cain, but it's sort of a gimmick. 999 is not, no matter if, even if Herman Cain is elected president, 999 is not going to be passed, nor is a flat tax going to be passed. I think we've seen in recent years how difficult it is to pass controversial legislation, with the health care bill especially, and the idea that a sweeping overhaul of the tax code that would eliminate many of the current provisions that give people, you know, deductions for their mortgage interest, give deductions for charitable institute contributions, give deductions for state and local taxes, is going to be an enormous fight in Congress, and the simplistic answers being proposed are just not going to happen. But, you know, people don't like the complexity of the Internal Revenue Code, and I think that's correct. As someone who does his own taxes, I can tell you that if it weren't for computer programs, I couldn't do it anymore, and I've been doing it for 35 years. And as far as the demonstrations are concerned, I mean, I think this represents, you know, just as the Tea Party represented a complaint against the way things were being run in the country from the conservative side, in a way this is a complaint against the way the country and business is being run from the liberal side. There's some good arguments there. The fact that that the tax policy of the United States has inordinately favored the wealthy, the fact that, you know, income inequality has gotten worse over recent years, the fact that in Wall Street there are these executives and who make these not only enormous salaries but enormous bonuses at a time that when many in the country are unemployed, and it's almost as if, you know, the companies are laying off workers to, you know, to, and using the money to pay the bonuses of the executives. So there are some legitimate complaints here. It's totally constitutional for them to demonstrate. Some of the issues come, and I think in many places they've sort of been allowed to do this. Some of the problems come when local governments, which are already financially strapped, find themselves having to pay extra police costs, extra cleanup costs, and things like that. So there's a conflict between that and the constitutional right to demonstrate. But it certainly represents legitimate concern about a legitimate problem.
Well, thank you so much for that call, Willem. We appreciate that. And we'll move now to Kenneth joining us from Janesville. Hi, Kenneth.
Hello. I was wondering if there's a narrative, a story about the beginnings of the Occupy Wall Street, in that by the time we heard it, about it on the news, there were quite a few people doing it. The pundits are saying that this could be the most dangerous thing that's happened to our country forever, I mean, ever, because, you know, the bonus march happened in the Depression, but this could involve large numbers of people in Washington, D.C., and all the big cities, and thousands could be out there with guns or whatever. I was wondering if you could comment on
Kenneth. Are you saying you're worried that the protesters will have guns?
Well, this movement could grow because there are so many, it could get out of hand and become a lot worse than the bonus march. I mean, hundreds of times worse than the bonus march of the 30s, where the soldiers in Washington, D.C. I don't know if they were shot at, but they were physically removed, and there was a lot of turmoil. They're saying they could be occupying Washington, D.C., I mean, thousands of people.
Well, I think that what Ken is getting at here, too, is that these protests so far, they're shape-shifting, and that no one knows quite what their final form will be. and, for instance, who gets to claim them. And I think people are sort of waiting to see what forms. What's your take on this so far?
Well, first of all, as far as the threat to the country, I think, the Carlo neglected the greatest threat to the country, which was the Civil War. That was a real threat to the country. And I don't know who's saying that this is a big threat to the country. I don't believe that. The bonus marchers, were dispersed, and it was sort of a messy thing for a while, but it didn't. And the fact that the country got through a period of, enormous unemployment and tremendous potential for social unrest as well as it did is a tribute to the leadership, and probably also the fact that media in those days was not as pervasive as it is today. I mean, I think the fact that, anything that happens is immediately on nationwide TV has a tendency sometimes to exaggerate the size of something and to make it seem like more than it is. In this case, so far, I mean, I live in Washington, D.C., and the main thing I've seen is that at McPherson Square, which is a square in downtown Washington, the protesters sort of have set up camp there. They've got some tents there, and there they are. Now, I don't know if we're going to have a big march on Washington and millions of people. I think that the press coverage initially was somewhat minimal, simply because we've seen an awful lot of demonstrations over the years, and the ability to get a couple of hundred people and go demonstrate somewhere is no longer a big deal. I mean, I've been around long enough to have covered the anti-Vietnam War demonstrations in the 60s, which were pretty large. But these days, we get groups that come to Washington, and even the ones that get, a couple of hundred thousand people, which they bus in, it gets some coverage, but it's not taken as a tremendous uprising. And this development I think the call is right. We're not sure where it's going to go. It's sort of leaderless at this point. The goal isn't clear. If the goal is to get Wall Street to give back some of its bonuses or Congress to change tax policy, they're not likely to be satisfied anytime soon. The Obama administration, of course, is trying to, include additional taxes on the wealthy as part of any budget deficit reduction plan. And most of us who, see a possibility of a significant plan acknowledge there has to be a tax provision, and the increased taxes of wealthier Americans is an obvious target, but not clear that that can go. Congress is staying gridlocked. And the only way Congress is going to be ungridlocked in the next session, frankly, is if the Republicans win everything, and then, they're going to, go back perhaps to policies that are more like the Bush economic policies than the Obama policies. The House seems likely to stay in Republican hands. The Senate, with a small Democratic majority now and a lot of Democratic seats at stake, including one in Wisconsin, there's a very good chance it's going to go Republican. And even if President Obama is reelected, he's going to have to deal with a Republican Congress. So
you think if the Republicans make giant gains in the 2012 election that they could end gridlock? Because, I don't know, the Democrats won it all 4 years ago, and gridlock was still just as present as ever.
That's right. I mean, it depends. It's going to be very difficult for them to do it. The biggest problem is in getting anything done in Washington. The two big problems. One is the fact that partisanship has gotten to the point where there are very few members of Congress in the middle. The middle has steadily decreased over the last 20 or 30 years. So both parties tend to vote much more as a bloc, especially in the House. The Senate, but the bigger problem is the fact that because of the Senate's filibuster rules, which were not invoked over the years nearly as much as they are today, basically, if no party has 60 votes, the majority party has under 60 votes, it has difficulty getting things done. And the fact is, the only time a party has had 60 votes in the Senate in the last 30 years was a brief period early in the Obama administration before between the time that the Minnesota Senate race was settled and Al Franken was seated in June of 2009 and the special election in Massachusetts in January of 2010 where Scott Brown won the Ted Kennedy seat. That period of about 8 months was the only time anyone had 60 votes, and the Democrats did take advantage of that, you know, to pass the health bill. But the fact is, it's very hard to get things done, and if the Republicans win the Senate, the Democrats are going to be the ones in the Senate throwing parliamentary roadblocks in their way. There are some ways to get around it. There's a process called reconciliation, where you can do things with a majority vote. But I would suggest that anything on major change on tax policy is going to be sufficiently controversial that it is going to be very difficult to pass as on a party line basis. We had tax reform 25 years ago in 1986 during the Reagan administration, and it was passed because it had bipartisan support. There were significant Democrats and significant Republicans involved in it. And as long as each party is trying to do its version of economic policy and is unable to attract any support from the other party, it's going to be very difficult regardless of who has the technical majority.
Thomas Friedman, who is the foreign affairs correspondent, or columnist rather, for the New York Times, he was interviewed recently on Wisconsin Public Radio, and he said that he thought the only thing that would shock a political system that a lot of people think is just broken at this point is to have a viable third-party candidate. Now, whether or not that third-party candidate would actually win was beside the point to him, but he thought that was the shock that the system needed.
Well, you know, and there are other people who feel that way. To have a viable third-party candidate, you need two things. You need to have the infrastructure to get that party, that candidate, on the ballot in every state. In fact, there is a group, a nonpartisan group, that is trying to basically get a spot on the ballot for an unnamed third-party candidate. But what you really need is the candidate. I mean, if you look back at third-party movements in the United States, for the most part, they have required a single candidate. Theodore Roosevelt ran for president as a third-party candidate after being denied the Republican nomination. He was a major figure, a former president, and he finished second in that election, got more votes than the Republican candidate. George Wallace ran as a third-party candidate in 1968. He was a significant political figure. He got votes in a number of states and some electoral votes. Ross Perot got, I think, 19% of the vote as a third-party candidate in 92. But significantly, he didn't carry a single state. And in fact, I'm quite familiar with analyses that have been done of that election. And although there are claims to the contrary, it's not clear that his candidacy really had much effect in the end, because he took more Democratic votes in states the Democrats carried, and he took more Republican votes in the states the Republican carried, and his main impact was to reduce the margin of the major party candidates. And he had money, and he was in the presidential debates, and I think that illustrated how hard it is for a third-party candidate. Now, if a third-party candidate succeeded, and we have not seen any individuals so far who could be a viable third candidate, you know, one of two things are going to happen. One is if, for example, if Mitt Romney is the Republican nominee and conservative Republicans get together and decide to go in a third party and, say, nominate a Michelle Bachmann, let's say, I think the main impact would be to drain off Republican votes and help President Obama be reelected. If you had a genuine third-party independent candidate, someone sort of in between the two extremes of the two parties, and that candidate were able to get electoral votes by winning some states, the main impact might be to throw the election into the House of Representatives. You know, if no candidate gets 270 electoral votes, the House of Representatives elects the president. And the House of Representatives votes, each state has one vote. And we don't know the shape of the next House that would do this, but in the current House, the Republican candidate would win. the fact that California has a heavy Democratic majority, California would have the same one vote as North Dakota or South Dakota with its single Republican congressman. So, and that would elect the Republican. So that would be the impact. So I think there's going to be a lot of talk of it. I think it's possible there'll be a third-party candidate. Most likely it would be, as I say, on the right if Romney is the nominee. But whether that candidate could have a significant impact is something that remains to be seen.
Okay, well, let's get one more phone call in before our next break. Let's take Don in La Crosse. Hi, Don.
Good morning. How are you today?
Doing well. How are you?
Alive and kicking.
Well, that's good to hear. What's on your mind?
Well, I've got two things from watching politics go on lately. To me, the Republican Party politicians have become the joke of a politician. What are the jobs of a politician? To get into office and to stay in the office. And watching what's been going on, I see Republicans lying an awful lot about what they're promising to do. And I see what they're willing to do is starting to sound an awful lot like pre-Hitler Germany to me. All they're willing to do are take away the rights of the American people, and they're attempting to go to a one-party system. When a politician says their primary job is to see that the president is a one-part or one-term president, they don't need to be in office anymore. To me, they are not doing their job. The biggest thing they need to do is find jobs for people in this country and to get the rich people off their dead tuckuses and to start creating businesses.
All right.
Put people to work.
Okay, thank you for your comment, Don. Appreciate it. And Mr. Lewsdorf.
Well, I think that's frankly an extreme point of view. This is not like the Germany before Hitler. The fact that there are extremely conservative candidates in the opposition party who don't approve of the more liberal policies of the current administration is hardly surprising. The fact that and I think the caller alluded to that Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell said in an interview that his number one goal was to make Barack Obama a one-term president, has frankly given Obama a speaking point in talking to going to the country that rather than trying to solve national problems, the Republican Party was determined to play politics, and gives him a good argument. But whichever party wins the election, I mean, the other party, we'll still be there. You know, I've gone through a lot of elections in my lifetime, and I can remember a number of times when we all wrote after the election that whichever party lost the election, and I'm thinking of the Republicans after the Johnson-Goldwater landslide of 1964, or the Democrats after George McGovern was routed in 1972, or more recently, even the Republicans after the Obama victory, we always say that the losing party is in danger of, you know, extinction or falling apart. And, you know, the system seems to be quite resilient because the losing party seems to rebound fairly quickly. And part of this, I think, has to do with the fact that that it's hard to solve some of these problems, and it's increasingly difficult for Democrats or Republicans to govern and to, you know, to make major changes in economic policy or other domestic policy. That's one. The other is that American people are essentially centrists. They're moderate. Sure, there are people on the extremes of both the left and right. We've seen, you know, I think in that caller we see the view from the left, and in some of the candidates like Michelle Bachmann and Herman Cain, we see the view from the right. But the dominant and the important part of the American public is, you know, the 20% who decide elections, who are swing voters, and that the American people are essentially in the middle. They don't want to go to extreme. They always reject the extremes. In every election where there's been an extreme on the left or right, they've ultimately rejected that extreme. So it's, you know, I'm not as concerned as this caller was.
We're talking this hour with Carl Lubsdorf. He's former Washington Bureau Chief of the Dallas Morning News. And we're talking all things political this hour, taking a look at the latest developments in campaign 2012, also the Occupy Wall Street protests, and kind of the political system in general as it stands. And we'd love to hear from you this morning. Our call-in number, 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And you can always send your email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickard. I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickard back with you for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And coming up at 1 o'clock today, students discuss how loans have affected their decisions on Talk of the Nation, plus the opinion page. That's 1 o'clock's Talk of the Nation. We're joined by our guest, Carl Lubsdorf, this hour. He's former Washington Bureau Chief of the Dallas Morning News and is current weekly columnist for McClatchy Newspapers. And let's go to our next caller now. We've got Taylor, who's joining us from Rushford, Minnesota. Hi, Taylor.
Hi, I just wanted to have one question and one comment. Question I have for the guest is, why is the mainstream media so afraid of a guy like Ron Paul? And then the comment I had is, we hear everybody talking about, how extreme some of the Tea Party Republicans are, and the guys like Ron Paul, the guys and gals, how extreme they are. But what I think is extreme is what's going on now. The Tea Party and Ron Paul, well, the Tea Party has kind of been hijacked, but the original intent of the Tea Party was to take things back to the way they were and the way the founding fathers had intended, and people think that's extreme.
And Carl Lubsdorf?
Well, let me say, first of all, that the founding, to go back to the way the founding fathers wanted it is not exactly practical in a country of 300 million people compared with what the United States was in 1789. It's just, you know, it's not going to happen. It's not going to go, you know, enormous change like some of the proposals are just not going to happen because it's essentially, as I said, a centrist country. It's not going to go very far. Now, why, Ron? Let me talk about Ron Paul, because I'm very familiar with the fact that, you know, he has a very strong cadre of supporters who feel very strongly. One of the things they feel is that he doesn't get proper media coverage. And I think they have a good case on that, frankly. I wrote a column about Ron Paul about a month ago in which I raised that point, and I said that I quoted Mr. Paul as saying one of his problems, he thinks, is that people don't really understand what he's saying because he talks all the time about Austrian economists and about rather, you know, arcane economic theories that are a little difficult to get across. Now, whether he's and I said also that sometimes he sounds like he's on another planet, and that in any case, I got about a dozen emails from Paul's supporters, almost all of them thanking me for writing a column about him, you know, because they feel he's so overlooked. Now, is he an extreme candidate? Well, he wants to get rid of, I think, 5 cabinet departments at last call. That's a pretty extreme position to do that. If we have, you know, 14 or 15 cabinet departments and suddenly we're going to get rid of 5 of them that have been passed, many of them by bipartisan majorities over the years, and perform a useful service, I think that someone could call that extreme. It certainly would be an enormous change over what we have now. Now, the Tea Party does want enormous change, it says, but what it really seems to not like are some of the federal programs that are being passed and the fact that there is a federal government that does a lot of things. They think the states should do it or the localities should do it. Well, in many cases, the federal government has done these things because the states didn't do it, or while some states took care of their people, some do not. And one reason to have a national health program with everyone required to join is that there are states like Texas where a large proportion of people don't have any health insurance coverage. That's why there is a movement for nationalization and for national programs. What Obama proposed and what actually was passed was fairly moderate when it comes to health reform. I mean, the liberals wanted a government-run single-payer program, which Obama rejected and Congress rejected. There was a vote on it in the Senate, I believe, and it got beaten. And, you know, so, and his plan operates through private insurance companies. So it's, you know, it's a rather centrist program, but to the Tea Party and to the other conservative critics, they're arguing it's a government takeover of health coverage and the nation's health program, which in fact it's not.
Can we go back to Ron Paul for a moment? You said you wrote about him in your column, and you wrote that he sounds like he's from a different planet. What do you mean by that?
Well, just because he proposes things, he talks all the time about sort of arcane kinds of issues, like the economic issues and going back to the gold standard and various things that, you know, are sort of theoretical and not really practical. The other thing we've noticed about Mr. Paul is while he always polls between, 5 and 12% in polls, in the past he's shown any difficulty in getting beyond that. And when I mentioned before that I thought the key to the Republican race are this 50% of conservatives who are, you know, sort of bouncing around from one candidate to the other, I didn't include Paul in that. I think, you know, we've got the Romney supporters, the quarter to a third. We've got the 10, 12, maybe 15 even percent of Paul supporters. The question is whether any of these groups can grow. There's no sign. There was no sign when Paul has run previously that his support ever gets beyond that hardcore of very enthusiastic people he has. And there's been no, I mean, in the campaign, he's gone up a little bit. He's gone down a little bit. There's certainly, you know, there is a big void on the Republican right, and there's been no sign that he's going to get enough public support to fill that.
Okay, well, let's go back and get in a couple more callers, maybe before the end of the hour, which is creeping up here. We've got Tony joining us next from Tomahawk. Hi, Tony.
Good morning. I appreciate your guest. I appreciate that he's attempting to do journalism. I have a comment and a question. The whole Herman Cain, the smoking ad that came out, people across the country, all the columns were filled with just that discussion about what that means and is he going after the smoking vote, when in fact the guy who was his campaign manager originally from Wisconsin was the head of Americans for Prosperity in Wisconsin. For God's sakes, any journalism person who reads a newspaper knows that's totally funded by the Koch brothers, and they gave us recent elections in Wisconsin, and the Americans for Prosperity group is a front organization for the Koch brothers, whose father was the founder of the John Birch Society, the biggest funder of that group. The fact that they totally missed that, and all they talked about is this guy was smoking on camera, it's absurd, it's an embarrassment, and I would encourage your guests to call out other so-called journalists and ask them to do journalism. The second question is, why is it that nobody, absolutely nobody in the major media, will ever challenge just absurd statements that have been made, particularly by Republicans of late, about we need a balanced budget amendment? For God's sakes, the only party that's ever balanced the budget five times was the Democrats. Republicans have never done it. Other leading Republican politicians say things like, well, you know, Obama's doubled the deficit. That's not true. Why don't they just confront that and say, wait a minute, where are your facts? And ask for some facts. Journalism is appallingly inept of late.
Okay, well, thank you, Tony. And Carl, are our journalists giving a free pass?
Well, I think, let me say something quickly about that ad. I think the big attention to that ad and the way it took off is a really sign of, it's less bad journalism than the trivialization of politics, and especially presidential politics. I think it's fueled by talk radio and by you know, 24-hour news television. What happens is that when something like that happens, which is basically insignificant, I think the caller is right, then you got three shows the next day on MSNBC all discussing the implications of this. Now, it's interesting. Mr. Block was actually on television this morning on Chuck Todd's show on MSNBC, and the Daily Rundown, and he was and Todd asked him about the connection with the Koch brothers and with the Americans for Prosperity, and he sort of discussed that. But there's no doubt that there's a connection there. This is a very conservative group that has spent a lot of money attempting to influence politics in the direction of, you know, fewer taxes for the wealthy, less regulation of industries. It has been reported, it has been covered, but sometimes these trivial things get more attention than others.
And we've got about 20 seconds left.
As for the balanced budget amendment, the balanced budget amendment is a crock in it. Most people know it, but it's another gimmick. It's been reported a lot. It's true that the deficit went up much more under Bush than under Obama, and that's another thing that's never going to be enacted.
Well, thank you so much, Tony, for the call. And Carl Lubsdorf, thank you so much for joining us this morning. It's been great to talk with you. Appreciate your insights.
Well, Veronica, enjoyed it.
Carl Lubsdorf, our guest this hour, former Washington bureau chief of the Dallas Morning News, and he currently writes a weekly column for the paper and its website, dallasnews.com. Currently, current weekly columnist for McClatchy Newspapers as well. I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned. There's more to come.